This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hi, I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat and welcome to Night School, the show that explores key themes in history, the social sciences and the humanities. Together with Sharat Kutan, we critically unpack theories, frameworks and social phenomena, the better to understand how society works. Each week we discuss a classic text, theme or an idea that we hope to shed light on the world around you. Joining us today is Elaine Frances Fernandez. She is the acting head of the psychology department at Help University, and this is under the Faculty of Behavioral Sciences. And we're here to talk about knowledge transfer and knowledge sharing. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for it.
So let's just introduce you to the show first. What's your area of interest and why do you think this topic is interesting to talk about?
Okay, so I'm a social psychologist by training, but I'm an educator at heart. So one of the reasons I came back to academia was because I enjoy the process of education. Mm-hmm. And certainly it's something that I think about a lot. Mm-hmm. And in my current role as well, it's really important because I'm steering the educational sort of direction of mm-hmm. the department. So it's something that I've put a lot of thought into and read about, talked about with my colleagues.
Yeah,
you know?
So it's really like an obsession, but in a good way, it sounds
We are a little bit obsessive, I'm afraid.
No, yeah. I think so. I think to be an educator, there is this active, ongoing thought process, right?
That yes.
never quite stop, because a good educator can draw connections, right? Can draw yes. connections between the material you're teaching and real life, right? Because part of effective teaching is using right examples, relatable examples, so on and so forth. So if you really want to improve your craft, that drawing of links between different things, I think, is a skill that is something you should hone, right? And that happens in your head. So I can totally relate in the sense that for me, when I take a course seriously and I want to do well in it, I always want to think about, well, how do I present this in the best way, right?
Yes.
And then especially if you're in social psychology, I'm in cultural studies, it's not something that just stops once the bell rings, right?
It's
something that you kind of live with. I want to know more about where you're coming from, in that you say that you are a social psychologist. So just in general, so that our audience is familiar with that term, how does that differ from, say, psychology as it's conventionally done?
Okay, so social psychology is one of those areas that people often take for granted as being common sense, because we deal in how people relate to each other, how people interact. So it can go from anywhere as so micro as how an individual is interacting with his environment, to how communities engage, to how governments influence people, people influence governments. Governments influence each other. So there's a lot of almost like an interdisciplinary aspect to areas of social psychology
Where
we sort of straddle the line sometimes between sociology and anthropology and things like that. So, but it's a psychology or it's a psychological science, because the focus is ultimately on how these impact the individual as opposed to the larger structures.
Now, how scientific is this, right? Because when you talk about anthropology, I mean, they're very good at questioning these epistemic frameworks, right?
Yes.
And psychology being very science-oriented, right? So where do those two meet and where do they diverge?
I guess that is one of the debates in social psychology, especially the further away you go from the individual's sort of psyche, where the line is between sociology and psychology. A lot of social psychological theories were sort of generated from the lab, basically. So you would think about things like social learning theory, you know, the idea that people observe models and transfer that learning. That was observed in a lab. So in that sense, there is still a scientific bent to social psychology, but the nature of it is this interdisciplinary. So I guess the underlying idea is that people don't exist in vacuums, you know. So it's really important to understand what's going on around them as well, to fully take stock of what's going on within the person themselves.
Yeah, and it's a very interesting insight, right? But it's so hard to really accept or pin down. I mean, in the sense that we tend to think of ourselves as these isolated units, because life socializes us that way, right? We think of property in private terms. We think of space in private terms. We think of our emotions in private terms. So the default orientation is always to say, well, I'm my own person that's divorced from the world, and I have to make an effort to socialize, when in fact you're already a socialized creature. It just hasn't registered in your psyche. So I think that's very interesting that the kind of work is being done. Now, where does knowledge come into this? That's our topic today, and particularly knowledge sharing, knowledge transfer, the way that knowledge moves, right? So how does this relate to your discipline, your area, more broadly?
Well, knowledge share, knowledge transfer is social, right? So regardless of which way you look at it, if I'm telling you something, that's a social process. And if people are sharing together, it's also a social process. So learning about how that works in the education context, so how is the educator impacting the student? And likewise, how is the student impacting the educator? I think a lot of educational models in sort of the Malaysian context, for example, tends to be very either focused solely on the student or solely on the teacher. And that's not really how a classroom works. You know, so anybody who's taught before knows that different classroom makeups, different students, different batches, you interact differently with them. You know, there is some elusive sort of chemistry. So understanding that process as well is incredibly important. So the two-way process that happens in the classroom is important. So where the transfer and the share part comes in is, I think, to some extent, the orientation of the educator, in the sense that, am I coming into the classroom to tell you what I know? So transfer the knowledge to you, and then you just take it. Or am I coming to the classroom with the perspective that, okay, I may have, I don't know, 5, 10, 20 years more, spent 20 years more reading about this, talking about this, learning about this, than you might have. But does that necessarily mean I know everything?
Does that make us the authority? Right?
Exactly. Yeah. So a lot of the previous approaches to education was one where you put the lecturer as the expert, the subject matter expert. And to some extent, that's true. I mean, we do have people who are great leaders and thinkers in their areas, but it's not possible to know everything that's out there.
And
in a class of 300 people, there are 300 minds that are not being tapped into if it's a one-way process.
Definitely. Especially in maybe our fields, right? Because I sense a lot of overlap, because cultural studies is about understanding contemporary culture, popular culture. And so much changes every day at the level of the consumers, right?
Yes.
So my students, they're from 19 to 22 mostly. And the way that they interact with popular cultural products, movies, films, songs, memes, is just an alien experience from what I had at their age. So I may have the bookish aspect of things, right? The theories, the studies, but they have the actual experience. So I know that whenever I come into that context, I only have a portion of the subject matter in hand, because they are the ones who are, who these things are catered for to begin with, right?
Yeah.
So in that field, but I can think of other things as well, even political science, right? Because you're always going to get a new batch of voters every elections.
Yes.
And typically the young voters are always so significant, right? That aspect of how politics is viewed and politics experience is something that maybe a 60-year-old professor who's published volumes might not know, right?
Exactly.
Because there's just that generational cultural gap.
Yes. And if we're not tapping into that, if we're not drawing upon their ideas, their experiences, it doesn't help us, because obviously you get left behind, I think, if you're only talking to your peers. Because we are all either of the same generation or even older. So the ideas that we generate get sort of caught in a bubble, and we're missing a lot of very interesting insight. But I think it also does a disservice to the students as well, because they start to think that there is a right and wrong. And when there is a right and wrong, I'm always looking for the right answer. So they discard the things that may not matter so much, or they perceive may not matter so much, to the lecturer, or they don't pay as much attention to that. So they start getting very sort of narrow in what they learn. And I think that's a problem, because, I mean, critical thinking, sort of contextual thinking was always important, but it's even more so now, because people are having to move between cultures, between organizations, between countries. So how quickly you adapt to different environments is incredibly important. But if people are always looking for the right answer, they're going to be sort of hindered in their experiences outside of school.
I like it that you mentioned contextual thinking alongside critical thinking, because I think the critical thinking part is the cognitive side of things, where you're looking at the logical connections between ideas and statements. But contextual thinking is about moving across spaces, across ages. And that's a skill that's very, very hard to get, you know. So I appreciate that a lot, because I think effective teaching is about contextual thinking. Mm-hmm. It's about knowing who your audience is.
Yes.
But also knowing how to switch tones, right? Because
yes.
I get it that we don't want the old school top-bottom style of knowledge transferring, right? Mm-hmm. We want something more dynamic. But we're still, quote-unquote, the authority. We somehow have, quote-unquote, power.
And, yes.
But we don't want to be completely subsumed by that either. So this is where I think the art is very interesting, right? Because you want to learn too. A good educator wants to learn, right? A good educator is not just going to say, I have it, you listen to me, right?
Yes.
So, I mean, how do you balance that? I mean, how does one study that even, right? So I guess I'm curious now about the method. We know that it's not easy. It's very contextual. It's a lot of instinct involved. How does one research this, and how does one come to conclusions as to what's effective and what's not?
The research aspect is interesting. I guess a lot of research into this area, to be frank, has been in terms of looking at schools or departments where this kind of thing, approaches to teaching has already been done to some extent. So looking at the students and asking them how effective, how they feel afterwards, so level of autonomy, that kind of thing. A lot of research recommends that we do sort of quasi-experimental research where you put people in different contexts and see it. To what extent is scaffolding necessary? Mm-hmm. How much independence do you give people? So manipulating that part. But it's difficult to pinpoint. And certainly, I think that's the challenge that faces a lot of educators. And I think that's why we sometimes shy away from it. Mm-hmm. Because we want to create a space where people can learn independently and also interdependently. But where does that line end? I think is where it's hard to draw. So in terms of the method, I think different people, this is where it gets tricky, because obviously different people have different strengths as well. So not everybody can do the Socratic method, for example, which is supposed to help with that. But I think maybe for an educator, sort of giving students a space to talk is probably an important first step, because sometimes we don't do that, especially when we have 300 students with thinking.
And I think sometimes there's a risk in being too charitable as well. I've had some nightmare classes where I walk in precisely with the attitude, you know, I'm trying to be like some Renaissance man, like starting a Dead Poet Society in Bandar Utama or something. And then, you know, the kids can spot. I mean, it's a power dynamic as well. They can spot your weakness, you know, and and they're not always going to be kind and patient with you, right? Sometimes you have to just be that uncle who's going to nag at them and telling them about how their parents sacrificed to send them there and stuff. I hate doing that, but sometimes that's just in your toolbox, especially when you deal with these like Klang Valley brats. Sorry to say, a lot of them are, right? I get it that it's about the cultivation of the human person. I love the aspect of education, but you know what? I've had some tug of war, some heavy, difficult moments with students as well.
I think it's about realizing that, okay, fine, you know, you want to cultivate thinking, you want to cultivate your ability to sort of critique, right? But life isn't also just about my opinion, right? So you have to learn how to work within the context. So it is still contextual intelligence in a sense that, okay, I give you the space to air your opinions, we learn from each other, but ultimately you're still working towards something, which is your degree in this case. So you have to, you know, fulfill the demands. We still have standards to meet. And whether they like it or not, we set those standards to some extent. So yes, in the classroom, we think. But then after that, we still have to evaluate the output that you have, you know, the work that you do. You still have to follow deadlines. You still have to follow regulations. So learning to deal with ambiguity to some extent is also about realizing that no matter what context you go into, there are structures, there are sort of boundaries that you have to work within. So if you somebody with good contextual intelligence knows how to do that. It's not just about what can you argue, it's about what can I argue that fits and that allows me to work best in this context.
I agree very much so, and I want to probe more on the details of what you just said in the second part of the show, but let's take a break now. You're listening to Night School. I am with Elaine Frances Fernandez today. She is the acting head of the Department of Psychology at Hull University. And we're talking about effective knowledge sharing and knowledge transferring in a classroom setting. And I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, you're listening to Night School. I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat. Joining us this week is Elaine Frances Fernandez. She is the acting head of the Psychology Department at Help University. And we're talking about effective knowledge sharing and knowledge transferring. In the first part of the show, we went over the challenges of what makes good knowledge transferring, knowledge sharing, right? What makes good interactions between students and their instructors, and how to make this as dynamic as possible, right? To take into account their experiences and context and what instructors need to do, right? The obligations they have as educators. Yeah. I want to talk about how one gets this knowledge, because the things I know, I only could have known through experience, right? Before I taught in the States, they gave us like this 3-week seminar on effective teaching and preparing stuff. And I thought that was already very good, because I had taught before that in KL, and none of that. I was just thrown in the deep end with the sharks, right? But when I went to the States, there was a little bit more thought into the process. Sure. And when I was preparing to teach there, they made sure that they gave us even a textbook. They told us these are the things you can think about, these are the models you can use, blah, blah, blah. But then as soon as the show started, I was again like out of my depth, you know, because certain things you only know in time. Now, how does this feel? How does this discipline? How does your research then address that? Because it's not like a static canon.
Yeah.
And it's so individualized, right? Different instructors bring different energies. So how do they meet that? How do you balance between the objective and the subjective?
Wow. That is the age-old question, isn't it? Transferring from theory to practice. I think first and foremost, it's important that people even know the theories to begin with. I think, as you said, a lot of us come into education because we enjoy it, because it gives us a space to work with ideas, to generate ideas. And I think that's the kind of people who are attracted to education in the first place. But a lot of educators are not actually exposed to what you can do as far as, you know, methods go, as far as educational philosophies go, I think. And that does pose a significant challenge, I think, to what you can then decide to do in your classes. In terms of what people can do in, you know, in relation to their classes, I think the first thing you need to do is spend some time understanding the dynamic in your class. I think we often go in and then we react. So students are all on their phones. No, am I boring? Am I not engaging them? But I think part of the problem is we feel like the onus is always on us to teach versus them to learn. I think there has to be that give and take. So how do we get them then to become engaged in the process? So what methods? So there are tons out there, I think, you know, having gone through a few classes yourself. But a couple that I've tried, I guess I can only speak from experience, is things like peer-to-peer interaction, for example. Getting them to talk to each other, they're much more inclined to talk to each other. And it does actually work in the sense that you suddenly hear a buzz. When you go around, you hear them speaking to each other. So it's not that they're not listening. It's just that it's very passive. The minute you introduce an active element into the class, then the level of engagement does go up. So whether or not you know or you can see that they're bored or whatever, then at least getting them to talk to their friend. They're processing something. And the feedback that I've gotten, I think it, we usually get feedback at the end of the semester, is that that's something that they enjoy. The group discussions, stopping the class when it's a particularly difficult concept and going, right, guys, explain it to each other.
That's good. Yeah, that's a good one. I think just fundamentally what I tell new teachers or whatever is that you're not really in control. You know? If you want to control what exactly goes into their heads or what exactly they're feeling when they teach you, you're going to go insane, right? What you can do is meet or set these specific targets, what you want them to know. Give some tests or some kind of conversation to check if they get it. But then you got to know that at the end of the day, there's probably, I don't know if you're lucky, you know, 50 or less people, but if you're unlucky, more, that you have very little control of, right? And the second other thing, other tip that I give is that that's a chance for you to learn. Not just about the material. I think immediately the payoff is that you know the topic more. And you know how to present it better. And if you can tie it to your research, you leave knowing it better. But the other thing is that you learn a lot about people.
Yes.
Right? That's, I think, one of the key things. Like, just knowing about how to relate to them, mm-hmm. how to understand them better. And there's a kind of world that you get an access to throughout the semester, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really, really rewarding and rich,
it is,
right?
Yes.
Being able to have that sort of conversation.
Yes.
It's a chance to grow in a lot of ways. One of the things that I'm also curious about is the affects, you know, the dynamics within a particular context, in the sense that everybody brings a different level of energy mm-hmm. to that classroom any given mm-hmm. time, right? And this differs across classes. So just as an example, when I was teaching before, the schedule was such that I had to teach 3 back-to-back classes.
Wow.
It was the same topic, right? Now, eventually, sometimes it was difficult, but the good thing is that after the first class, the second and third time, I have to regurgitate the same material. It mm-hmm. was much easier.
Mm-hmm.
I could anticipate the questions. Mm-hmm. I knew what example to use. But I realized, outside the pedagogical aspect of it,
mm-hmm.
that the dynamic for each is very different. Even though it's the same amount of class, even though it's the same
topic,
even it's the same examples,
yeah.
you know, I could tell a joke, the same joke in the same way, and each class will react differently. That's why I'm so funny today. But I got practice, in other words. So it's really weird to me that, okay, it's the same amount of class. They're very strict about not exceeding the amount of 30 per class. So there are 30 each class,
mm-hmm.
right? Same age, same class demographic, more or less. And then every class will react differently. And that, to me, is so fascinating.
Yeah.
In the sense that they all bring different dynamics and they all feel the material differently, right?
Yeah.
So that's one of the joys, like being in those moments when you realize, wow, like this is what human interaction is like. So dynamic, you can't predict it.
Yeah.
And the back and forth, the repartee is just mm-hmm. has a life of its own, right? Yeah.
Yeah. I think what you said earlier about recognizing that you don't really have a lot of control in a classroom, especially in higher education, because you are dealing with adult and adult learners, at least that's the way we want to think about it. And so the level of independence that they have when you're sitting there, they're no longer going to listen to you when you, mm-hmm. you know, become the big teacher man. So that poses a real challenge to people who maybe came from a bit more traditional education backgrounds, maybe from the age where the lecturer is at the podium, everybody's in the seat and you just listen.
Mm-hmm.
So the way education works now is so different. I think young people are becoming a lot more confident,
mm-hmm.
a lot more assertive. And I think that's a good thing.
I think so too.
I think it's important that they know their own minds and they know how to challenge. But as people from a more traditional system, I think we need to be a little bit more fluid, I guess, in mm-hmm. our approach. And I think if you realize that you really don't have that much control, so how do you work with rather than against that dynamic? So cooperation with the students, I think, tends to work a lot better than trying to be the authoritarian figure in the room.
No, I agree. And sometimes the problem is that society idealizes teaching and education, and mm-hmm. sometimes the teachers themselves internalize those ideals mm-hmm. when it's actually a difficult job. It's emotionally demanding.
Yes.
You're being stacked with more and more admin work.
Oh,
at the same time, you're supposed to be this source of knowledge that's mm-hmm. supposed to be like constantly calm and objective and mm-hmm. has all perspectives in hand. No, you're a human person and you mm-hmm. can be overworked. You can be frustrated. Mm-hmm. And you bring some other in class, you know. And then mm-hmm. when that happens, all hell breaks loose because they expect the teacher to be like, it's not the 50s anymore, you know, like where teachers are really an elite profession.
Yes.
Nowadays, it's become such an industry. People mm-hmm. are becoming dispensable. There are emotional mm-hmm. demands to teaching as well that I don't think the industry talks about enough.
No, it certainly doesn't. I think that expectation of teachers to always have the answers, I think that's also a bit of a problem, because on the one hand, students are going out and reading more and so on. And so they come across things that somebody with a more than 40-hour work week, for mm-hmm. sure, because when you're at work, you're at work. When you're at home, you're reading. And you don't always have time to read. So we have marking to do. We have administration to do. So I might be aware of what's going on in my very small subject mm-hmm. area of expertise, but the fields are so wide.
Mm-hmm.
And often at undergraduate level, you have to be a generalist in what you teach.
Mm-hmm.
So social psychology, for example, has hundreds, if not thousands, of theory and theoretical approaches.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not going to be an expert in all of those.
Yeah.
I might know a small area very, very well. Everything else I'm reading and I'm learning as I go along. So there's definitely going to be somebody in the audience who's read something newer that I may not have had the chance to come across yet.
Yeah.
So I think managing that expectation is important as well. So getting the students to understand that, okay, I'm going to make mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
I am going to, at some point, say something that may have been debunked a few weeks ago, you know? So it's okay to bring that up, but how you bring that up is important.
Yeah.
So I think if the educator is open to that, open to correction, I think that's important. But a student who is doing the correcting also maybe take into consideration that this person is not teaching you out of bad faith.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
But it's harder to have that sort of conversation when, in effect, the institution treats students like clientele.
Yes.
Right. They think of these students as paying customers. And the students, they, some of them, many of them, in fact, think of themselves as that as well. I paid for this. My parents paid for this. I want top service.
Yeah.
And essentially, teachers become service providers in that sense.
Yeah.
So that to me is another problem that affects the environment as well, right? And we don't talk about it enough in a sense. Parents don't talk about it enough. Students don't talk about it enough. Admin clearly don't talk about it enough. And certainly the teaching staff don't either. Like,
we may a little bit.
A little bit. Yeah. Sometimes just to vent, right?
Yeah.
But the idea that the nature of the interaction is significantly colored by cost benefit considerations, right?
Yes.
Profit motives. It does affect what the students can expect out of the class and what the educators can provide, right?
Yes. And I think that is a systemic sort of societal issue, because obviously the situation now is, or at least the perception rather, is that everybody needs a degree in order to get into an industry. Therefore, if you're preventing me from getting my degree, you're doing me a disservice. So universities are less about learning, about exploring, about expanding your horizons, and more about, I need to get this piece of paper so that I can go and do what I want to make my money. And I understand that. It is the nature of the world today where you kind of need at least a basic degree. Now, everybody has a basic degree. But that's slowly changing because everybody has a basic degree. So I think it will come to a point, and there will be a tipping point where people start to realize that it isn't enough just to graduate. You need to be able to display certain skills if you want to be sustainable in industry, and certainly if you want to progress. So the ability to navigate different environments, the ability to problem solve and so on is so important. So the students that come into an education institution thinking that all I need to do is pass, they're going to be in for a pretty rude shock once they enter the working world, because that is not how, you know, organizations operate. You have to deliver top quality if you want to progress.
And on the other side, in the provider side as well, I think there must be a realization that educators are not machines. You know, I think we can do better jobs if we are not so always pressed against the wall with a lot of admin work. But that's a separate conversation at a time. I really want to know more about the Malaysian context, because I think it's fascinating. One of the things that I enjoy about teaching here, having taught in the States before in various contexts, is the cultural diversity, right, especially at private institutions, but also in that cultural diversity, different epistemic frameworks, right? It's not just that, granted, in the States, there are different culture, but it's still more or less working in a sort of Western framework that everybody sort of signs up to. But here is a bunch of things clashing together, and a good educator has to kind of know, like, these different frameworks are kind of being brought into the discussion. To me, that's a lovely, lovely challenge to have. Like, do you experience that as well? Like,
Yes, certainly. I think we, I mean, as an educational sort of system in Malaysia, you have so much diversity depending on where a student comes from. So a government school is going to be different from a vernacular school, from an international school, from a private school. So everybody's coming into the same context with different experiences with teaching. So people who are used to more independent learning, they get a bit frustrated with the one-directional way of teaching. People who are used to being spoon-fed appreciate it when they're spoon-fed. So I think for me, it comes down to, this is where being the educator is important. So not just part of that process, so this is where being the educator comes in, I think, for me, is making that decision about what you want, or what you think the students must get out of that class. So the learning outcome that you want to see. And sometimes that means challenging some of those frameworks. That means getting them to have to come out of the comfort zone that they're used to. And unfortunately, most of the time, that means challenging the traditional spoon-feeding way of teaching.
Yeah, this is where I think the tutorial component is very important,
Yes.
Because my class, just a basic snapshot of the demographic there, you have about 60 people in the class, you have about 25 Malays, and not all of them, you know, one is from Kajang, a few are from the usual Sri Hartamas, Monkera area. But you have a few, about four or five, who are not from the KL urban area.
Right.
One's from Arau, Perlis, another one's from Johor, right? And then they have this different sense of the subject matter from the background that they come in. And then you have the exchange student from the UK, you know, with their familiarity with the kind of thinking I want to do, you know, but they're not quite sure about the context that I'm going to bring it in. So to me, every time I go in, it's a different subject material, in effect, because I have to think about, all right, how am I going to present this in a way that speaks to these different demographics, right? And then you have the occasional Nigerian there, Central Asian there. It's really rich. And this is in Semenye, you know, of all places. It's so surreal, right?
Yeah.
So I guess what I wonder about then is, can we think in terms of these identities? Like when we think about teaching in Malaysia, we're not necessarily just teaching Malaysians, right?
Yes.
And we're not necessarily teaching Westerners either, right? These categories seem limited when you want to think about what exactly is this context I'm working on, right? So I think the notion of context itself has to be expanded, right?
Yes.
Because in a globalized setting, this is the ideal, right? That everybody comes together to talk about world issues. But I don't think the categories have caught on yet.
No, certainly not. And I think it's good that you mentioned tutorials, because certainly tutorials is where you can actually draw on this diversity. In the lecture setting where there's 200-400 students, it's harder to do. You will get the more vocal ones speaking up, and those tend to be from backgrounds that have encouraged that. So tutorials is, I think, one of those ways that we can actually get those different opinions out and then, you know, see how to manage that. That's where I think maybe the Socratic method might be really useful. So, because it's not about judgment, it's not about evaluating your opinion in a kind of positive or negative way. It's about trying to understand, okay, so you have a different way of viewing this. How did that come about? What's driving this? How would this influence your actions and so on? So actually getting them to see that there is a diversity, that not everybody thinks the same way, is also very useful, I think, as a teaching tool. And if they hear it in a safe environment, which universities tend to be for the most part, then at least they're learning to some extent to see that different people do have different views.
Yeah.
And then when they come out to the workplace, that's not going to go away.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's going to help.
What I emphasize too is that their comfort levels in talking about certain things are already advantages in knowledge, right? In the sense that Americans have very difficult experiences with talking about race.
Yes.
Whereas Malaysians are more comfortable talking about race than them by comparison, right? And I don't mean like in terms of technical, theoretical skills. I just mean the comfort in talking about it, which to me, and I'm sure you appreciate this, so as educators, just getting them comfortable to talk about something is already
difficult.
Major gains, right?
So
in that sense, Malaysians are more like ready to talk about labels and stuff like that. Granted, crudely, but that's a raw material for you to work with, right? So to have these higher level sort of conceptual kind of thinking. But Americans are more ready to talk about sexuality than Malaysians are, right? So when I have them in the same room, right, I try to point out these differences, right? In the West, yes, you think you're free because you can talk about X, Y, Z more openly, but you have very, very ridiculous struggles talking about ABC, right? Whereas here in our context, we're more adept at thinking about ABC than XYZ. So there are things you can learn from each other as well.
Yes.
The comfort levels that you can kind of draw from each other. And those are assets, right, in the long run. Unfortunately, we have to pause because time's up. But maybe we can have you over again to kind of go in depth in some of these themes.
Yeah.
But I like it that a lot of thought is being put into teaching. And it's happening in Malaysia because I don't think we quite realize the kinds of things we can think about here, especially when it comes to teaching.
Yes.
Yeah.
I agree. We have such a rich context for education, and if we're not actually making full use of that, I think we're doing ourselves and our students a major disservice. So
I'm curious as well about the kinds of convergences in your work, because you are essentially running a department, and that brings you the policy level of things, but you also like teaching, obviously. And I know that those two worlds don't always talk or always see eye to eye, right?
Yeah.
So maybe next time we can talk a lot more about the implementation level of things and the limitations there. Yeah.
Yes.
So how can our listeners get in touch with you? Are you on Twitter? Facebook, maybe?
I am on Facebook, LinkedIn. I am on Twitter, but Twitter tends to be more where I retweet stuff.
Sure.
So LinkedIn is probably where you would be able to find me easily.
Great, LinkedIn. The other thing is LinkedIn is another underappreciated tool too for things. Also, I guess they can look you up at the department website if they want to know about more your work.
Definitely,
yeah.
Yes,
do you have recommendations for texts for our listeners, maybe?
For texts for... I look
like
at...
Like books, maybe, or papers even?
Well, off the top of my head, there is this book by Larry Smith. He's a educator from, well, he's an economist by profession. He recently gave a TED Talk called, well, recently, I say recently, no, actually it was like 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. A TED Talk on why you will fail to have a great career. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if you've heard this.
No, I haven't actually.
It's actually really interesting. So
sounds like I need to.
Yeah. So go look him up first. Mm-hmm. It's on YouTube. I would start there.
Okay.
And listen to the challenges, I think, posed to students in today's sort of market and
Interesting. I looked that up. Well, I just have one book that I turn to a lot. I mean, Pedagogy of the Oppressed, Paulo Freire, right? And he has a good critique of the banking mode of knowledge, where I think the earlier, in a earlier part of our discussion, we talk about how educators are expected to just hammer data into people when that's not what education is supposed to be. So that chapter is very, very good. Yeah. In any case, thank you for joining us. You have just heard BFM Night School. Our guest this week is Elaine Frances Fernandez, the acting head of the psychology department at Help University. Be sure to email us at bfmnightschool@gmail.com if you have any messages you want to pass along to the show. Look us up on Facebook too, BFM Night School. Type that on the search space. And of course, download our app. You can find it at Apple App Store or Google Play. Once again, I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat. Alongside this week, Elaine Frances Fernandez. And this is Night School on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.